Nadia Spajoli, it's a pleasure having you here in Norman, Oklahoma.
Thank you for having me.
You write about Iran. You're an Iran specialist. You're a PhD. You've written on the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, and their media operations. Tell us a little bit about how the revolutionary side of Iran tries to project itself. What are its objectives?
Sure. When I was starting my research, my sort of big question was, how does a revolutionary regime that's become the status quo keep commitment to its original revolutionary ideals alive from one generation to the next? And in Iran, this is an important question because over 75% of the population is under the age of 35, meaning they don't remember the revolution. And so what I wanted to really focus on is look at how the Revolutionary Guard and the paramilitary Bastige organization, which is sort of under the Revolutionary Guard, use media to communicate these ideas that they have about the future of the Islamic Republic to this young generation specifically.
Now, the IRGC reports directly to the supreme guide, to Khamenei, right?
Yes.
Not to the parliament, not to the president.
No.
Right. So now where does the army reports also?
Yeah, so in Iran, there's a division between the sort of regular army known as the Artish and then the Revolutionary Guard. The Revolutionary Guard was set up to sort of safeguard the revolution because Khomeini, when he triumphed in 1979, believed that the military was still too loyal to the Shah's regime, and he feared a military coup d'etat. And so that's why he went and set up the Revolutionary Guard. However, in post-war Iran, and the war that I'm referring to is the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, in post-war Iran, there were more and more leeways given to the Revolutionary Guard to begin reconstructing the country after the war. And so today, yes, the Revolutionary Guard sort of responds to or answers to the supreme leader. But at the same time, what's key to note is that the Revolutionary Guard today is the biggest and most independently wealthy institution in the Islamic Republic.
It has about 4 million people in it. So how big is a Revolutionary Guard?
I mean, the Revolutionary Guard itself is, you know, all of these things become very complicated to actually pin down number-wise because you have the people who are in the different armed forces of the Revolutionary Guard, from the Navy to the ground forces to the Air Force. But at the same time, you have those who were veterans of the Iran-Iraq War who served in the Revolutionary Guard, who now are no longer active members but are veterans and still sort of identify themselves as a part of the Guard. And then you have those who have sort of retired from the Guard but have gone into business. And so when we talk about, you know, the businesses that the Revolutionary Guard control, what we're actually sort of referring to are these contracting and subcontracting companies that have been set up by people who were in the Revolutionary Guard but who have now sort of since turned to businessmen. So, you know, it's difficult because we in the outside
of Iran,
how big
a part of the economy is that? I mean, these are so important because everybody argues in the States, oh, the IRGC is too powerful. It's got all of this control over the economy. We're never going to change Iran. The moderates can't win. And let's stop trying to placate them.
Well, I think there are a few problems to that sort of line of thinking because, first of all, it assumes that the Revolutionary Guard is monolithic, and it's not. It's not a monolithic organization, and it assumes that there are not moderate and reformist components within the Revolutionary Guard, and there definitely are. So one thing that I think, and what I'm trying to show through my research, is that this organization and the paramilitary Bastige organization are actually much more heterogeneous, and there are so many different kinds of thought processes and people who have different notions of what the future of
the
politics.
So you could get reform coming from within.
Yes,
these
you definitely
revolutionary
can.
Forces. It not unlike the Communist Party in Russia, where we saw it evolve, and ultimately it was the communists who decided they'd had enough and they wanted to change the country.
I mean, within Iran, in the past 15 years, the political leaders of the reformist movement have been within the rank and file of the Islamic Republic. I mean, it's driven from a bottom approach of the population pushing for that, but you have politically reformists from within the regime wanting reform. You also see the same thing in the Revolutionary Guard as well. I mean, especially once you mix, in my opinion, money with ideology, as the Revolutionary Guard have with the businesses that they have, at the end of the day, it becomes very difficult to know if money wins out or if ideology wins out. And I think especially, you know, with the heavy sanctions regime against Iran, yes, there were parts of the Revolutionary Guard that were heavily benefiting from the sanctions, but there were also other parts of the Revolutionary Guard and some of their businesses that were not benefiting from the sanctions regime and would actually benefit from a more sort of open trade relations with the rest of the world. And so these are things that it's difficult because outside we see them as being so sort of monolithic, and they're definitely not like that.
The idea of an Islamic Republic that was established in 1979, which is that God should rule. Man should not rule. Iran came up with this hybrid regime in which is sort of a bit republic and a bit Islamic, in a sense that you've got a supreme guide, Khomeini, who is supposed to be the highest cleric, the Murja Taqlid, that everybody should emulate, the Pope, if you will, of Shia Islam. And yet you've got an elected parliament with some notion of popular sovereignty, and a president who's responsible to the parliament. It's an odd hybrid regime. How many people in Iran believe in the idea that God should be the ultimate authority and should be ruling man, and that man can't rule himself?
First of all, the notion of the rule of jurisprudence, which Khomeini created prior to taking power in Iran, you know, some people have said, okay, well, this is a traditional sort of idea, and he implemented that. He created that idea. I mean, it was, there are many Shia clerics who do not agree with him and this notion of the rule of jurisprudence.
But the rule, the idea that God should rule, we've seen it in the Muslim Brotherhood. We see it in the caliphate that ISIS created in Iraq and Syria. The idea that God is supreme and that humans are his servants, and that they should not be making legislation, that this is arrogance, and it's arrogating the position of God in society, that is, in a sense, creating polytheism. And that's the critique of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamists writ large, Islamists in Iran, whether they're Shiite or in the Sunni world. And it's an idea that flies in the face of Enlightenment values that the United States is always kicking the Middle East to digest. And in some ways, the Middle East is torn between these two ideas, and there are people who are pulling on both sides. How do you, you know, if you had to rate for us where that struggle is in Iran between these two concepts of sovereignty, God is sovereign or humans is sovereign, where is that contest today?
I would say that among the general population, there has been evidence and very strong evidence of a push to strengthen the Republican part of the Islamic Republic and sort of decenter the Islamic part as much as possible. Some of the clerics who are involved in the politics of the Islamic Republic obviously have a vested interest in not having that happen. But the non-clerics who are involved in the Islamic Republic, as well as the general population, are sort of pushing for the more Republican side of the Islamic Republic rather than the Islamic side. And we see that from popular protests that erupt in the country every few years to just general discussions that happen in the newspapers and on television and radio within and outside of Iran. So I think that this is something that has been an ongoing and very vibrant discussion in Iran for at least a decade and a half, if not a bit more.
So you sound hopeful that reform can work its way, in a sense, a British model, where the vote gets broadened out, as it happened in Britain in the 19th century. You have a monarchy and a parliament at the same time. And that the franchise, which went for only a few small property people, was broadened, the voting franchise, over a period of 100 years. A little bit less, I guess, in England. And women got it in 1920. So it took a long time to bring everybody into this election. You are hopeful that this kind of evolution that's non-revolutionary, nonviolent, could take place in Iran, and that that you don't expect to have a big revolution where the Islamic part of it is going to be overthrown violently.
Well, look, I think if anyone predicts revolution or not, I think, sorry to say, but I think they're a fool, because it's very difficult to predict social movements in any country around the world. I mean, President Carter is famous for, on New Year's Eve in 1978, he was in Tehran and he toasted to the island of stability in the Middle East, meaning Iran. And within months, there was a popular revolution. These are things, we saw it with the Arab Spring. We see it with revolutionary movements pretty much anywhere around the world. It is extremely difficult to predict social movements, when they will come, how they will take place. So I'm not going to predict one way or another. But one thing that we have seen in the past decade and a half in Iran is a very conscientious move, especially by women and young people, to push for reform within the country. And when there was a massive a popular uprising in 2009, after the contested elections there, there was a huge push for reform, but not a push for revolution. And one of the things that you hear a lot of in Iran is, because the revolution there just happened a generation and a half ago, you hear a lot of young people saying, we don't want revolution, look at what revolution got us. We want things to sort of happen slowly, and they're moving in the right direction, many people believe. There are lots of bumps in the road. There are a lot of frustrations, but the demographic reality in Iran is on the side of reform. I mean, it's on the pure basis of the youth population is just too large, and that population wants change.
So if I hear you correctly, if you're advising the U.S. government, it is be patient, be liberal, open trade, help build a middle class in Iran. Don't starve it. Don't sanction it. Don't treat it in the meaner way. And it'll take care of itself. The Iran is on the right track.
Yeah, I definitely believe that. I mean, I think you have a very highly educated population, a very tech-savvy youth population. You have women involved in pretty much all sectors of society.
Let me ask you about women. You went in your 20s, after growing up in the United States, coming here when you were three, you went back and spent a long time in Iran doing research. And what was it like being a woman in Iran? Was it what you expected when you went there, having grown up in the United States? Was it different? What did you notice?
You know, especially in the urban centers in Iran, and I was living in Tehran for most of the time, and that's a city of a little bit over 11 million people. So it's a very massive city. For the most part, women are visible in every single sector of society, the women's movement has been the strongest movement in Iran since the 1979 revolution, especially against the government. And it's a very strong movement. It's a very active movement. It's a movement that is constantly pushing for change. And because of that, you have a situation in which, yes, there are difficulties, especially, for example, women still cannot be judges in Iran, but they can be lawyers. There are certain sort of restrictions put in that way. However, you now have a situation in which over 60% of the university population in Iran are females.
Wow.
So these are things that women were not granted but have taken. And because of that, you have this grassroots movement that is sort of women themselves are pushing themselves into all different parts of society. And I know from the outside, people think of Iran and they think that it's this very oppressive place for women. And there are definitely oppressive laws in place. I'm not excusing that. But on the ground, you see women active in every single sector of society.
Narges Bajoli, it is a pleasure to be with you today.
Thank you for having me.